Gemara in Yoma, Ayin Hey Amud Aleph, says that the mun was used to decide whether if the husband had intent to actually divorce the other one, the wife. So if the mun, and it's in this, it's shishi of bashach, it's depending on which person, how much mun went to that person. So if the mun was in his house, then it showed that he really did, it was something wrong with her, he didn't really want her to go. And if it was in the father's house of the mother, then it was her fault. Not her fault, the husband really wanted her to go, so really he did have to give the ketubah.
That is a great suggestion for synergy. So I will definitely take that because there's no reason why that synergy should be any less than what I was thinking of. So definitely, had I announced some huge, massive prize, I would regret it because now I'd have to give it to you. But sorry, for today, yeah. We could possibly offer you a free lunch tomorrow, but we'll have to see.
What was the actual?
The synergy that I was thinking of, I don't think anybody would guess, because it requires not only a familiarity with the Gemara in Yuma, but, which is not to put that down, because that's huge, we're very pro-Shas, also a familiarity with the Sefer Vikvei Hatzon, where Rav Shechter Shlita has a fascinating Chiddush, which, as you remember, we had time constraints on Wednesday when we were doing Parsha Shir, which is really a chaval because there's so much to discuss in those aliyahs. Maybe next year I'll remember that we gave short shrift to Shishi and we'll revitalize it then. But even just the few words we tried to say about the man and lessons from the man, there wasn't enough time. So we have this opportunity today to synergize with that point because there's a fascinating chiddush that Rav Shechter has about one of those psukim. That's in the Sefer Vikvei Hatzon. And there he discusses that, he quotes from the Brisker Rav and the Kedushas HaLevi, that's Kedushas HaLevi is the Rav Levi Yitzchak Berditchev, that he discusses there the notion that the language of mitzvah in the Torah, of tziva, is only applicable to something that's a part of the eternal Torah. That's something that is a mitzvah l'doros. And when you have something that is a haras shah, something that is a temporary instruction, so then that language is not appropriate. So, based on that, this is opened up this chumash before I started talking, but based on that, this is one could ask a question about the aliyah that we discussed last week, about the two aliyahs that we discussed last week, which seem to contradict this, really more than once. But here, so he discusses the possibility that tziva is a language of eternal Torah, zehadavar is a language of eternal Torah, as we see from the Kedushas Levi. So how do you explain this pasuk? Zehadav, this is Perek Tezayin, pasuk Tezayin. Zehadavar, asher tziva Hashem, liktu mimenu, ish lefi achlo, omer lagolgoles, mispar nafsho seichem, ish lasher ba'olo tikachu. Right, just instruction about the man, that everyone should go and should take enough man for his household. So, the man is halavai, that was a mitzvah of Doros, but the last I've heard, man is hard to come by. So, it's reasonable to assume that any instruction in the context of a man was temporary, was a haras shah type of context. So how could you say that gathering the man has anything to do with any kind of eternal mitzvah? So he suggests, there are fascinating suggestions can be seen in the Sefer Be'ikvei Hatzon, in the essay which is entitled the Megillah HaKsuva Vein HaKsuvim, which is where he has this whole idea of Horal, Shah versus Torah, Mitzvah, Zehadavar. So he says, the mitzvah that is included in this pasuk that is relevant to all the generations is the obligation to support one's wife and children. And that's what's happening here. So, ish lefi ochlo, omer legolgoles, mispar nafsho seichem, that's the part that is relevant in the long term. The man, okay, that was the vehicle at the time, and that's not something that we have access to now, but the notion that the man is told to go out there and make sure he has enough food for his wife and children, that's a mitzvah l'doros. I think that's a fascinating point. Yes, sir?
Is it a gender essentialist chiddush?
Depends how you want to define all of those terms. And, the fact is, this is what we have in our ksubas. And the ksuba says, "Bane Eflach," that the man declares that I will go out and I will work to support the family. So he corresponds that line in the ksuba to this pasuk. That this language, which has this mitzvah ledoros kind of language to it, even though it's in the context of a very clearly temporary point of history. So that's the suggestion that he has. I think it's a fascinating idea. And that is, of course, one of the major pillars of the prenup. So, just to kind of bring that back into focus and to try to get as much as we can done and get done before mincha today, hopefully to really kind of wrap up this topic, even though there's so much to say about these things, if you want, you can come back to these issues later on in the year as well, but we should probably speak about Purim in the upcoming weeks and things like that. So we'll try to get at least this stage finished today, but again, later on in the year, I'm happy to come back to any aspect of this whole parasha that you want. But just in terms of the prenup, so this obligation that a man has to support his wife and to support his family is a very major pillar of what makes up the prenup. So just to kind of recap what we're up to, so we had discussed how the question comes up if you have a situation where the marriage is over, but let's say in this case the husband is not agreeing to end things. So what can be done to encourage a speedy resolution of the situation? So we had discussed when is kfiya appropriate, what is a valid method of kfiya, what is a valid method of encouragement when kfiya is not justified. So here we work within the premise that kfiya is not justified. Even though that may not be true, maybe kfiya is justified. And we mentioned a few shittos which would allow for kfiya in pretty broad circumstances and therefore give us many situations where it is justified, maybe according to some minority views, would cover almost all such disputed situations. But still, to be on as solid halachic grounds as possible, we're not assuming kfiya to be justified, and we're trying to create a mechanism here that works even without a basis for kfiya. Right, so far so good? So the two get laws that exist in New York have different levels of effectiveness and acceptability, as I think we mentioned last time, that the first get law was much less controversial and also much less effective. And that basically just said that a court has the right to withhold a civil divorce from any party that is making it impossible for the other spouse to remarry. So that doesn't have much objectionable halachically, but also it's possible to get around it. So it didn't really accomplish so much. The second get law was much more controversial, continues to be much more controversial, and that is the idea that the judge has the right to allocate the assets. When he has to divide up the marital property one way or another, that's a part of every divorce, but the fact that he's going to do that is going to be influenced by one party's refusal to allow the other party to move on. So there, the concern was that that basically amounts to monetary compulsion. So there are a couple of issues to clarify here. First of all, is there a problem with monetary compulsion? So we know that forcing somebody by beating him up is an issue. What if you're not forcing somebody by beating him up? You're creating a monetary pressure on that person. So the truth is, this was debated. Most Rishonim assume that it is an issue, that forcing somebody through the pocketbook is considered to be kfiya. But, of course, everything's a matter of degree. So we saw Harchakas Rabbeinu Tam, which we assume does not rise to kfiya. So there, the assumption was that that's legitimate even without a basis for kfiya. But it's going to involve some opportunity costs for sure. There's certainly going to be less profit and business problems that are going to come along with that kind of the pressure. So perhaps we have to distinguish between profits and continued success in business and taking away somebody's existing money, maybe. There are various scenarios that come up, and they're not all necessarily looked at the same way in terms of what constitutes monetary pressure. There are also those who assume that even, and this is certainly very logical, that even if you want to say that monetary pressure is considered to be pressure, so there's got to be some kind of a standard, some kind of a minimum, because if we look at the issue this way, especially we mentioned Rav Moshe Feinstein's position, at least his theoretical position, that somebody who wants to get divorced but is just focusing on other issues, that already you can be kofan those other issues because he's willing to divorce. So if that's the prism through which we look at this, so what kind of monetary pressure are we talking about? If you take a happily married man and he has no interest in divorcing his wife, so such a person is going to resist a lot to stay married. So if you say, okay, you can only, if you take a happily married couple and you could say, even if you were to say, let's say, okay, we're going to fine you $100,000 if you want to stay married to your wife. So probably they'll find some way to come up with $100,000, because if you're not interested in getting divorced, it's going to take a lot that's going to pressure you to make that decision against your will. So too here, there are many who suggest that when we talk about a concern of monetary pressure, it's going to have to rise to a certain level. It's going to have to be pretty extreme to constitute that kind of pressure that actually rises to the level of a get mausa. So if we're saying that it's the kind of monetary pressure that is somewhere in between, meaning that it affects somebody who isn't really interested in staying married, but he doesn't feel he has so much to lose by keeping things going, and now you're showing him that, no, he has something to lose, so now it's no longer cost-free for him to do this, so that's a different level of pressure, and you're compelling on a different point. So that might be significant also, and that's a part of a discussion that's requiring a lot of analysis and careful calibration that's outside the scope of our survey here. But that's just something to be aware of, that even if you assume that monetary pressure counts as pressure, presumably not every fine, every penalty that is going to be assigned is necessarily going to rise to that level. And a basic rule of thumb here is, if it's not going to have an impact on a happily married couple staying married, then one could argue that's not really relevant as far as pressure is concerned. So this is a big discussion. So when it comes to the New York State get law, the second one, so there were many poskim who were very concerned about it, some to the point of assuming that it really invalidates gittin, while others who felt that, no, it's not on that level, that maybe it's not a great idea, maybe it is a great idea, maybe it isn't a good idea, but even if it's a bad idea, doesn't necessarily rise to that level, but the evidence, because there are a number of arguments to rely on, at least after the fact. So what arguments could you rely on? So you could say, for example, that there is a view in Rishonim that monetary pressure is not called pressure. You could say, there's a tshuva about this in Tshuva's Beis Avi, which was written by Dayan Libis and Gedalia Dov Schwartz. Zayin Gesundt has an article about this as well, that there are various arguments that have been used to, at least after the fact, defend the get law, that the pressure is not significant enough, that Dina de Malchusa Dina is applicable here, and therefore whatever the judge decides is the allocation of property is a valid allocation of property. So therefore there's no basis to say the judge is stealing this guy's money. If the judge decides, this is where it goes, and that's true, and that will remove the whole issue. Rabbi Kohanan, I have to say the name, a word from our sponsor, so he has a tshuva where he writes that kfiyah is only really an issue if the kfiyah is so direct that it's at the same moment. You sit down at the table and you put a gun to someone's head and you say, write the get, that's kfiyah. But you create an overall situation, and then later on he comes and he writes the get, that's not going to be considered kfiyah. So all of these are invoked as possible arguments, together also with the possibility that maybe we do paskin like the Rambam about Moed Salai, or other arguments that allow for kfiyah, so that even if it is kfiyah, maybe kfiyah is justified in these circumstances. So there are a number of approaches that are advanced to say that this get law is not necessarily problematic, at least after the fact, separate from the question of whether it is a good idea or not. Hi.
Just in terms of people who dissent and argue against the get law, it's been like 3 weeks, so I apologize if we already guessed it.
That's okay.
So I remember hearing from my KGR Rosenberg that Sherman was very against the base of Yerushalayim, is very against the prenup starts.
Yeah, which I think is unfortunate. It's a recent statement that he made. And I'll say the Mechilas Kvodo, you know, I think it's a misreading of the whole document, that because he explicitly writes in his objection that we have now to segue to the prenup, but that it's a knas. And he writes that as if the authors themselves see it as the knas, and then he says a knas al piatzmo, he thinks there's a problem of monetary pressure. So, sorry? Yeah, well, first of all, he thinks it is too much money, which part of that is, but we'll point out, has to do with a difference in lifestyles that, you know, in America. So, for example, the prenup is calibrated to about just recap what the prenup involves. So now let's take a step back and then we'll get to this objection. I mean, it's a legitimate question. But that, just again to recap, what does the prenup, the RCA prenup, basically say? So essentially it says that, first of all, there is an agreement to a certain venue where this will be dealt with. And I think I mentioned last week that the default is the Beis Din of America, but you could write it in anything else also. You can make a prenup with a different Beis Din. And I think I mentioned last week that in my mind, in my experience, that will cover 98.5% of the cases. That the vast majority of situations that we deal with are situations where there is venue shopping that can literally go on forever because each side believes that they have found the venue that will give them what they believe is justice and fairness. And as soon as the other party just decides to be decent and comes along to their venue, it'll be resolved, kedasu kedin, and how could you blame me for causing a problem? It's the other party's fault. They're refusing to go to a objective, legitimate, for the tape, I'm air quotes here, objective and legitimate source of justice. So, because it's really what's behind so many of the situations, that can go on forever, literally forever. They'll just, each one says, okay, I'm right, the other one just isn't cooperating, and it's over. You know, it'll be over as soon as they cooperate. So, to have an agreement on the venue, that should really solve a huge part, the exception maybe if one party disappears, which occasionally happens also, but theoretically that should cover everything, and that should not be controversial at all. And that's something that Moshe Feinstein was on record as supporting, so just simply an agreement to arbitrate, it's very hard to see what is so problematic about that. So, for example, Ora takes this position that when they say that we should encourage every couple getting married to sign a prenup. So when one might respond, well, what about this halachic objection, my posix is this, is that? Don't think that anyone who can object to an agreement to arbitrate in a specific venue, and at a minimum, it should be that. You know, at a minimum, that will solve, it'll have a huge impact on how these things are addressed. But the more controversial part, but which is also a big part of the effectiveness, is the agreement to support, to maintain support. And basically the framework is that if the couple is not living together, possibly a few other conditions could be relevant as well, but whatever it is that triggers this obligation, so the husband will provide support for his wife, and the support is calibrated at a rate that is high but not unreasonable. And that's a very important window to reach, because we want it to be high enough to hurt, high enough to bite, but not so high that it's outside the scope of what makes sense for such support. And that if it were that high, so then that could call into question whether it really is what it says it is, and that it could cross the line from being plain support that we see from Parshas B'Shalach as the obligation into being punitive. And also could also reach asmachta territory, the idea that nobody ever would willingly commit himself to this, and therefore the whole commitment to begin with is under false terms. So yes, it's true, there's Sternbach in his letter, so he objected to the rate. In America, it's usually calibrated, I believe, at around $150 a day, which the assumption is that is within that window for American society. But in Bnei Brak, that might be considered very high. Or in certain areas in Israel, that might be considered very high. So it's true that it makes sense to calibrate it to the community in which the couple lives. But there is a number one can pick that is not too high. Whatever that number is, you can figure out what the number is, and that number should be reasonable. So that shouldn't be a posel in and of itself. but he also works off the assumption that it is a penalty. And you can make that objection in two ways. So one is to say that it's a de facto penalty, and that we don't believe that it is. We believe that it's the simple continuation of being married. And as again we see from Parshas Bashalaf, that obligation to continue supporting your wife. And more than that, the way it sounds like from the way Rav Schoenbuch writes it, is that it's not just a de facto penalty, but that it is stam a penalty. Like it's just this is the way it's set up to be a penalty, and that is clearly not the case. That's where I say it's a misreading, because the authors didn't phrase it that way. And I think we mentioned also that Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, one of the co-authors, has written whole articles to establish how opposed he is to the idea of self-penalty, that it's not something, and to explain from a Lumdish perspective why it's not valid to have a system where you commit yourself to punish yourself later. So that's certainly not the stated framework of the authors, and even if you want to say, well, I don't care what they say, it's still de facto penalty, still that's also arguably not the case, more than arguably not the case. Now, this question, which also comes together with Asmachta questions, should we say, first of all, that the most serious objection one could bring to the prenup is that it is Musa, that the person is being forced to do this against his will. The second most serious objection, which comes with this, is that it's Asmachta, that the whole deal is invalid to begin with, because one doesn't think it's ever going to kick in. And that could also then therefore make the whole thing illegitimate, so that could also nourish that first objection that the money is being taken in shelo kedin, and therefore it's monetary pressure that is not justified and invalidates the get. So the asmachta obligation, the asmachta objection is hard to sustain. First of all, it's done in a bez din chashuv, it's done with different aspects that address what concern of asmachtas happens to kind of synergize with our discussion about asmachta in the context of Arif, but there are ways to deal with asmachta. But the assumption that, oh, you never thought this was going to kick in, so the whole ksuba is based on such a premise that there's a possibility of divorce and that there are chiyuvim that will come along with divorce. So it's hard to say that the ksuba is not asmachta if you're going to take such a premise. Now, one could ask, maybe really there isn't much difference between the prenup and the ksuba. So why don't we just say that the ksuba is enough? The ksuba maintains these obligations, and therefore, who needs an extra prenup? Let's just deal with the ksuba. So the problem is the ksuba has loopholes. That it can be a big question as to, let's say, if the family is living apart, if the spouses are living apart, so whether or not there continues to be an obligation to maintain support for a wife who, let's say, has left you, that is very arguable. So it could become a major point of contention as to whether or not the conditions of the ksuba continue to apply. So essentially, what the prenup does is it basically closes off that loophole. So it really is very similar to the ksuba, but it's written in such a way so that you're not going to be tied up in Beis Din for decades arguing, is it his fault, is it her fault, is there really such an obligation or not. So with all that, so we think that these objections, some of them are more substantive than others, but that they're not objections that really rise to the level of disqualifying the prenup. And quite the opposite, the prenup really, if you get involved, you shouldn't know from it, but if you see some of the complexities of some of these situations, you'll realize that the prenup is really one of the only approaches that has any real solid chance of making a difference. And therefore, you should emphasize to all of your friends, to all of your sisters, to all of the people you know, that the prenup is an incredibly important tool to prevent these situations from escalating into tremendously, tremendously sorrowful and painful situations. Now, theoretically, there is a reciprocal prenup that exists also, that there are those who say, okay, so I'm willing to sign this, but it's discriminatory against men. It basically assumes that if the man holds the situation up, this is going to be the consequence. What about if the wife holds things up? And as we mentioned at the outset, that is not only possible, but it also happens. There are such situations where the wife refuses to accept the get, and we don't have to argue about what situation is more frequent or not, or the level of frequency, but the fact is the possibility certainly exists that the wife could refuse to cooperate in ways that will keep the man from being able to move forward. So there is a reciprocal version of the prenup, which Ora will also provide if one is holding it that parsha. And for some, that's a more appropriate choice. The only reason, I think, why it's not the default one is the one that got the endorsement of all the poskim was the standard one, which does put the penalty on the husband. So the claims of widespread support are really associated with that one, so that's the one that's initially put forward. And also, you can understand a little bit why, because this objection, or this argument, that it's not a penalty, but it's an extension of the normally existing obligation of support, works a little better from the male side. So why that's the default form that's out there, you can understand why, but there still exists an alternative option of a bilateral mutual prenup. Donnie.
How would it not be knas if the woman, the woman isn't chayav in providing for the family?
Yeah, it's a little trickier. You'd have to work out ways in which you either call it that she has an obligation of support, or to say, which, you know, she does have obligations to the whole, if you learn Maseches Ksubos, so the whole Ksubos is about that there are mutual obligations, that the assumption is that there are monetary benefits that go in both directions. So there is what to work with, or there is what to, let's say, subtract from on her side also, if that's the way you want to phrase it. So it's not impossible, but it works a little better in that sense. So, again, those are some of the objections, and those are some of the approaches to the objections. I think I mentioned last week that one of the more hard-to-understand objections in Rav Sternberg's letter, which I think is really unfortunate, because I think it's a mistake in that it causes a lot of confusion on this issue, which is very, very important. But there are other signatories who make their own points. Some of them are very hard to understand. So one of them, I think I mentioned the other day, and said, oh, the whole thing is against your will, because since the woman is not willing to marry without a prenup, and the Masada Kedushin is not willing to officiate without a prenup, so it's against your will. That is the most astounding argument. Again, it's like saying that you don't have to pay your mortgage because you didn't really agree to it, because they weren't going to sell your house unless you signed on it. You don't have to pay for your car because they weren't going to give you the car unless you agreed to pay, so it's against your will. I can't begin to understand that one. So, you know, that's, we're grown-ups, we can make decisions knowing that there are costs to them, and that's not called duress, and it's not called against your will. I mean, it's really just astounding to try to imagine that argument being made in any other, I don't even have to say any more about just how baffling that objection is. There are other objections which are much less substantive, you know, that it's not romantic to talk about divorce at the time of marriage, but again, that's what the ksuba does. You know, a lot of the objections are not as significant, and therefore are really not to be given any weight, considering just how serious this condition is. You know, somewhere in between is a little bit more serious, but still not enough of an objection that it's not about not being romantic, but that at the time later on, when there is a crisis, maybe the crisis theoretically could have been resolved, but this is kind of pushing and encouraging divorce with situations where there could have been some resolution. That's a little bit more substantive and a little bit in the middle, but again, the situations where they come up are situations where, more frequently than not, there has been enough tried and established, and there's only so much you can do to try to encourage shalom bayis when it comes at the very significant suffering of one or both of the parties. And it's hard to allow that to be an effective objection either. Hi.
What does the international Beit Din say?
Okay, so that question, so what I mentioned, there are other topics that we can talk about, so I'm happy to talk about these topics, but since it's almost Mincha time, so we can start the topic now, and I think next week probably we want to start to focus on Purim, but just to give you a sense of what topics you're bringing up, if you want to bring them up for a future Sunday, let's say, if we find time between Purim and Pesach, or the like. So one is, what are other remedies that have been suggested, which is relevant to what you just asked, and what are the pluses and minuses of that? And also the related topic of Hetamei Rabbanim and Cherem Derbeinu Gershom and the issues that are relevant to why it is that a husband can't just decide to remarry somebody else without it being accepted by his wife and the like. Those are two major topics which maybe we'll reserve for future dates. So feel free to remind me at a later date to talk about that. Alternative suggestions to dealing with the Aguna crisis and the situation with Hetamei Rabbanim and Cherem Derbeinu Gershom. All right, thank you for all your cooperation. So Morty, I think, did respond to me about tomorrow.